She rushes into his arms. He twirls her around, dips her, and kisses her. Then they come up for air and belt out a final chorus. The curtain falls and everyone claps. The curtain rises, and soon audience members start to stand and clap as the cast runs back on stage to take their bows. I stand and cheer, and so does Taj. When the show is over, we leave the theater like the rest of the audience, waiting and shuffling, taking our time.
"Did you like the show?"
he asks. "It was amazing. I've never seen anything like it." He smiles, and it's such a natural smile. His brown eyes light up, and I'm reminded of how pure the color is. They're a rich, deep golden brown, a few shades darker than his skin.
"I'm glad," he says,
and he seems both happy and genuine. My mom has always wanted to see a Broadway show. I'm going to have to tell her all about it, especially since she was a water artist. She would love it.
"What's she like, your mom?"
She's this smart, sweet, loving, totally vibrant woman. But she doesn't feel well most of the time, so she hardly ever leaves the house, I say, even though that's a distortion of the truth. She never leaves the house.
"Sorry to hear she doesn't feel well. That's a bummer."
"Yeah, it totally is. I can't even tell you the last time she saw sunshine or the ocean. And she loves water. I would love to take her to the ocean and see her swim again."
"She really doesn't leave the house?"
I shake my head. "No. Never, actually," I say, admitting the full truth now. Something shifted between Taj and me in his library tonight. It's as if there's another side on display now. The prickly, caustic granter he was last night is gone, and he seems like a friend, so I keep talking. One of the reasons I'm even sticking with the Leagues at all is to raise enough money to help her somehow, to get well again. I need to make enough money so I can get her out of the house and find a great doctor for her.
"You're a good daughter. I hope you can do that, Arya."
When we're on the street, he asks me,
"What now?"
I'm kind of hungry, to tell the truth.
"Do you like diner food?"
"I'm from the backwaters of Florida. We went to restaurants once a year. We ate rice and beans for most meals. I like anything." Soon, we're ordering chocolate milkshakes and French fries, and as we wait, Taj asks again how I liked the show. Then he catches himself, remembering that he'd already asked that question. He seems a touch nervous with me right now.
"You know I loved it."
"Did you like it?" I ask, turning the question around. I don't add that I want to go again, that I want to see more shows, that who knew I'd enjoy a musical so much. But I did enjoy it, so much so that it felt real, as if the boat were truly tossed at sea, as if the crew had actually saved it, as if the captain and his lady did live happily ever after. I believed in it, in the story and the song. He nods, and then we're both silent for a minute. And it's awkward because it feels like we're on a date, going to the theater, eating out, stumbling on words. But yet, we're also in the midst of a business transaction. I'm not sure how to steer things back to business without being a complete jerk.
"So, Arya, let's get down to business. You want a wish."
Maybe he is a mind reader. "Yeah, I do."
"And you feel bad for wanting it?"
"Of course."
"Tell me what you want."
"Now? Is this how it works? I tell you in a diner?"
"Sure. Or you could wait until I take you to the top of the Empire State Building on my magic carpet and tell me there."
He says it without irony, but I'm sure he's joking, so I manage a laugh. He raises an eyebrow, waiting for me to speak. "Why do you dress so fancy?" I ask to buy time. Taj glances down at his clothes, his pressed shirt, his dark slacks, his shiny shoes.
I was raised that the way you dress is a sign of respect for the people you work with, interact with. That's what my parents taught me. Where are your parents? Do they know you're a Granter? Are they Granters too? He shakes his head. Some questions I will not answer. But yes, they know. Do you ever see them? Never. Granters are forbidden from seeing family. That's sad. Do you miss them? Terribly. But, he says pointedly, and then stands up and joins me on my side of the booth, sliding in next to me. We're not going to talk about me now. We're going to talk about you. You should know you're free to wish under certain circumstances. I checked the registry, and you've never wished before, which means you get one wish. Registry? Like the Registry of Elemental Artists? Something like that. So tell me what you wish for. I swallow, bite my lip. I'm jangled inside, nerves exposed and antennae up. If I tell him why I need fire, he'll know I stole it. He'll know I did something punishable by the leagues. Taj, are you bound by our laws? If you knew something about me, something bad, would you have to turn me in to the leagues? The corners of his lips curl up. I am bound by you. I am bound by wishers. I am bound by the powers of granting. When I'm in your world, I do my best to pay my bills at restaurants and to cross when the light is green. But no, I'm not obligated, nor do I care much, for the laws that institutions lay down. My fire is running out, I whisper. Was it never yours to start with? I shake my head, relieved for once to be honest. It feels so amazingly good to admit this, to confess what has twisted me up for so long. It was never mine. I noticed your hands, the first night I met you. I try to shield my hands, to tuck them under my napkin, but he takes my right hand very gently in both of his. He turns my hand over, palm up. He traces my scars, my calluses. You were burned, weren't you? He asks, as if he can read my hands, as if my palms are telling him a story. Yes. He doesn't let go. He continues to trace lazy circles on my hand. I feel goosebumps on my arms. I look down at his fingers, long and elegant, charting the grotesque grooves in my hand. He leans into me and whispers, You stole your fire from the sky, Arya. There's no judgment in his voice. His tone is completely absent the damnation that stealing elements brings. I don't answer with words. I answer with movement, with the barest of a nod. I've confessed, and it feels strangely freeing. I open my eyes. And you want to be fire naturally now, he continues. You want me to give you the gift of fire. It is the only way you can keep moving, keep living. Now that you're in the ME leagues, you need it even more. Because powerful people now know what you can do. And if you're found out to have stolen your gift, terrible things will happen, and you will be exiled from the leagues. And you need the leagues for your very survival. I shudder, and it's as if the heat between us has been extinguished, snuffed by the reminder of choices and consequences. You promise you won't tell? I told you, I'm bound by the laws of my kind. I don't answer to theirs. I don't care if you stole fire. In fact, I assume you had a completely valid reason. He looks at my hands again. I don't have to assume, actually. I know you did. Do you want to know how I did it? I'm half shocked at what I'm saying, but I so badly want him to know all the things I could never tell Janna or my mom or my brother, because we were from the same place, the same people, the same rules. Taj is not. Here, with Taj, I'm able to let go of the walls, and I find that I want to. that I've been wound too tight for far too long by too many secrets. Of course, he says with a smile. I enjoy knowledge more than almost anything else. What do you enjoy more than knowledge?
Perhaps we'll find out. But for now, tell me how you stole fire.
I begin at the beginning, telling him about my brother, about his crimes, then the garage, the matches, the bandages on my hands, the trek through the swamp, the lady and her snow gator.
I've heard of snow gators.
You have?
Yes. I knew of someone who won a snow gator.
Won?
Sort of like in a bet. An exchange.
They say he became a snow gator because he ate an ice artist.
Maybe it's the same gator,
Taj says. Maybe. I continue my story, editing out only Elise's name, as I detail how the lightning enters my body, how my fire sharpens and strengthens, like a climber scaling a mountain peak, then how it unspools, the same climber tumbling down, how my own fire chokes me as it wanes.
Does it hurt? When the lightning hits?
I shake my head. Not really. I mean, it kind of burns, but I'm used to it. Taj holds up his hand, lets it hover near my chest, as if he can feel my charred heart. Do you want to feel my heart? Where the lightning goes in?
Very much so.
I take his hand, press his palm against my chest, just above my breasts. My skin is bare. I'm wearing only a tank top. My heart beats against his palm. His hands are so warm, but they're no match for the heat in my heart. Then the waitress brings our milkshakes and French fries, and we let go. We eat, and I know I want to drag out this wish for another night, because this is the closest I've ever felt to freedom. Chapter 20. An example of. Figured it out? Color me intrigued. Did you find another air artist who'll knock you out with lightning? Say it ain't so. Have I been replaced so easily? But seriously, if you have, that's awesome. Do tell, do tell. XOXO, Elise. Are you crazy? No way would I ever, ever, ever find another Dr. Frankenstein. You're my one and only. But, shh, I found another way. You know, that way. 1001 Arabian Nights way. He's beautiful, too. Love, me. The next morning, I grab my backpack, sling it over my shoulder, and pull my long hair into a high ponytail. I lock my room, practically bounce down the stairs, and meet Jem outside to head to practice with her. Jem is wearing silver flats today. They are covered in silver sequins. Her black hair is clipped back in a cascade of barrettes with bugs on them. A stylized ladybug, an elongated spider, even an ant. Cool hair bling. Cool ponytail. Right, it's such a talent. My amazing ponytail-making ability. I say dryly as we hit the streets. I root around for a pen in the front pocket of my backpack. I find my favorite blue one, the one I jammed in there this morning when I woke up with it in my hand, and shout, "Gotcha, blue pen!" Chipper this morning, are we? Jem raises an eyebrow as we stop at a red light. Maybe, I say, in the exact kind of tone someone would use if she were starting to like someone and wasn't sure how to tell her friend yet. Instead, I finish off a doodle I started on my thigh last night when I couldn't fall asleep. I kept replaying the moments at the diner. Taj's hand on my chest, how his skin feels, well, radiant, against mine. I study the drawing, a kaleidoscope of ink and flesh, and I see patterned swirls and whirls bending and weaving, as if I were looking through a lens to see a psychedelic image. I wasn't in the mood to mark up a too-school-for-cool model or sketch random thought bubbles in a magazine, so I took to my own flesh as a canvas. It's my most elaborate body graffiti ever. I cap the pen and drop it into my backpack as the light turns green. Jem points to my leg. That, my friend, is certifiably awesome. Certifiable something, that's for sure. I totally want you to do one on me. You do? No one has ever asked me to draw on them before. Hell yeah! I thought you were waiting till you retired from the leagues. For an official tattoo, but you can do a temporary one. Can you do a badass flower? Like maybe a daisy with a scowl on its face? I laugh at the image. Jem has a little bit of Angel in her, and a little bit of Ferdinand the Bull, too. She plays backup for Mariska each night on stage, but what she'd really rather be doing is gardening, making flowers, growing sunflowers and pansies and daisies, her favorite. Could you make it wink, too? Like a real sassy, saucy wink? Jem demonstrates, scrunching up one side of her face in an exaggerated and ridiculous mangled wink. Your wish is my command, I say. Then I look away, blushing stupidly at what I just said, and how it returns me to another memory of last night. Telling Taj all those things. I felt safe telling him my secrets, and it's almost as if I'm a little bit lighter now because of it, as if my shoulders have been unkinked after years of knotted muscles. Such a strange feeling, especially since none of my burdens are truly gone. So, after practice, maybe? Sure, but you have to do it on your leg. Duh, obviously, she says and bumps me. Thighs are always covered up, and while tattoos are forbidden in general, we can get away with homegrown markings on hidden skin. I yawn as we pass a truck backing into an alley. Out late last night? Actually, I was, I say. And since it felt so freeing to tell Taj the truth, I decide to give Jem a little bit of honesty, too. I think I kind of had a date. Think? You think? Spill. I want to know everything. I tell her. Not everything, not even close, because I don't breathe a word about his library or the way the underworld of New York City can shift and move like a secret map when you're with a grantor. But I tell her about second acting a show. I tell her about the diner, about how we held hands, and how we're going to see each other tonight, too. Jem grabs my arm. What are you going to do tonight? I shrug. I don't actually know. We kind of play it by ear. Wait. Is this someone you've been seeing before? Just once. We met the other night. But it feels like I have known Taj for longer. I'm sure that's what everyone says when they start to fall for someone. But maybe it's a cliche for a reason. Because when it happens to you, it's no longer a cliche. It's the truth. I do feel as if I've known Taj for a long time, and it's because he knows so much more about me than almost anyone. Well, what's he like? He's smart and funny and kind of sarcastic, but in this weirdly clever way, and I stop before I say the next word because I worry it might sound cheesy. And what? Jem asks with a rabid smile. Soulful. He's sort of soulful. And anything else? How does he kiss? I don't know. I don't even know if he wants to, I admit, because I don't. Sure, I felt a spark when he placed his hand over my heart, but I don't know if he felt the same, or if he can. Perhaps he was sweet to me simply so he could stay alive a little longer in between wishers. Maybe he is only nice because I'm his master. I must remind myself not to fall for him. I need things from him, and I have to find a way to pay for my wish. But how will I pay? With my life? I might have enjoyed talking to him, but if I get caught up in how free I feel with him, then I'll lose sight of the prize. Fire without stealing. You should kiss him tonight. Kiss him and report back to me. Speaking of kissing reports, How's it going with Henry from the jewelry tattoo shop? A discussion about kisses carries us the rest of the way to the facility, up the stairs, and into the locker room, as if we're floating on a well-drawn waft of something delicious, the morning after conversation between friends. I stop abruptly because the TV is on. The TV is never on. Jem and I turn to look at the screen hanging high in a corner. A news anchor, with a severe blonde bob, talks seriously into the camera. In Chicago, an 18-year-old boy was placed on probation from the leagues for alleged grand larceny today. Reginald Kramer is being held without bail for theft of air powers, according to officials from the leagues. A man in a pinstriped suit appears on the screen. His name flashes on the TV, and his title. Winston Cody, head of standards and practices with the ME Leagues.
We've been investigating Reginald Kramer for several months now, and have amassed a substantial body of evidence that we believe demonstrates his theft of the air element more than 3 years ago. This is a serious violation of league's rules, given that performances in the elemental arts are highly regulated, protected, and pure. If he has, in fact, stolen his powers, he will be banned, and his family will also receive a lifetime ban from the leagues.
A reporter asks Mr. Cody a question.
How did Kramer allegedly steal his air powers?
The specifics are classified, I'm afraid. But suffice it to say, he had an accomplice, and we're fully expecting to apprehend his accomplice at any moment.
The reporter tosses back to the blonde bobbed anchor, who recounts past cases of theft. The last known case of theft of elemental arts occurred 10 years ago, when a teenager in Saudi Arabia was found to have stolen water power. This occurred when the ME operated under different rules, and the teenager was promptly executed. In other news, I want to reach for Jem, to grab her, to tell her how awful this is. But I can't let on that I have anything in common with Reginald Kramer. So when Jem shakes her head and mutters something like, "How sad," I do the same, mimicking, as if I'm just a normal artist who acquired powers the normal way, rather than a thief, the mirror image of this Chicago boy. The news anchor begins talking about the stock market, but she's cut off and the piece starts over. It's being played on a loop. The anchor's voice is a rusty saw to me, and I have to get away from it. So I yank on my practice uniform and head to the field. On the field, we move through our drills, running laps in the rising morning heat, then sprints, then push-ups, then crunches. We separate according to our powers and begin rehearsing our tricks for the next shows, reviewing the familiar ones, improving the newer ones. As I shoot flames from my hands, I picture them, those who make the rules, those who require registries, those who get to decide who can and can't be powerful, who get to deem the ways we can and can't be successful. Those who don't care if you had to steal just to survive. Images of them, the rule makers, parade before my eyes. I grit my teeth, clench my jaw, and it's easy, so insanely simple, to craft my fire twin this time. Mateus hoots, and I'm shocked. I didn't expect to replicate myself. I didn't plan it. But as in wonder, as in my brother's warped world of underground raves and insane asylums, the fire has fled my body in the shape of me. Instinct kicks in, and I spread my arms over my head. My fire twin imitates me, creating an arc above her that shoots higher than mine, racing, sprinting to the sky. I clasp my hands instantly, and both she and her sparks are snuffed. Mateus marches over to me, beaming.
Tonight, next show. Can you do that again?
Yes. I answer without hesitation because I know now I can do it again. My twin isn't a fluke. I wasn't angry enough before. When I came to New York and moved away from my father, it's as if the distance muted my anger. But the rules and the laws and the stupid, awful reality of my half-baked heart are all too real once again. I don't even know how I'll pay for my wish, but I'll have to figure that out soon. And hell if that doesn't make me mad. I fire off several more replicas, several more copies that shoot flames as high and as wide as they can go. Mariska watches me. Her jaw-dropped, googly-eyed stare makes it clear she'd never mock me for my work ethic again. The fire inside me crackles and growls. It burns off corners of who I am, like flames stalking through a forest, ripping off branches and swallowing twigs. I keep going, an artist gone wild, who no longer makes sparks and starlight, but fearsome, legendary, wild duplicates. If my father were here right now, I'd shoot fireballs in his direction. Then I'd roast marshmallows on the flames as he cooked. I'd watch, steely-eyed, as the fire he tried but failed to make in me, the fire I went out and took from the sky, burned him alive. My image is broken when Mateus whistles. I notice all the coaches and all the teammates, and even a few of the staffers, the woman who processes paychecks, the guys who clean the locker rooms. They've all migrated to the field. To see the girl Prometheus do the thing she skipped a grade for, to finally, after all this time, deliver. To see her unleash wildfire from her hands, bending, racing, rising high and hot above us, obedient to only me. Fueled by the desire not just to kill her own father, but to also rage against all the rules that have trapped her, that have made her into this. Something I never ever wanted to be. Now I am. Now it's awful. More awful than it ever was. Chapter 21, Master and Servant. It's show night, and Intrepid Arena is packed. Imran is here, Mateus called him after practice. Imran was in Boston visiting some of his under-scouts, who check out the newly gifted and chat up parents about the farm leagues. Mateus told him to take the next shuttle back, and now Imran is here in Central Park for tonight's performance of Cœur de la Nature. He finds me before the show, plants his hands on my shoulders.
I knew you'd be a star.
He's beaming, proud of his find. I don't know what to say. My heart feels like coal. My head feels vacant. I am probably narrowing my eyes at him, at this man who gave me every chance I've ever wanted. Only, when I take those chances, I feel parts of me sliced off, making room for darkness, for badness, like my brother warned. I force my mind to my sister, to her sweetness, to her snarky sense of humor. It makes me feel the slightest bit human again. She is worth this. She is worth everything I will ever have to do. Thanks. I walk to the stage, decked out in the slinkiest of black outfits, a sleek, tight thing covering most of my skin, and I give the audience what they want, fireworks and flaming art. Then I move on to the main attraction, to the special trick the audience has been whispering about since they walked down the aisles, slid into seats, and waited with their programs in hand. They'd heard tonight's show would be special. Rumors had started to spread. At last, the girl from Wonder might be wonderful. I start small with the twin, moving her hands and her arms with mine. Then I move on to the release, to the flames she shoots high. Her shadowy, shimmery talent elicits gasps and cheers. I even turn in a circle, my twin turning with me. Bending, bowing, almost dancing, though I don't really dance. But then, she has a mind of her own. She steps without me. I startle, look at her, my mouth agape for the briefest of seconds. Then I snap my fingers to turn her off. But as she burns out, one small piece of her flames shears off, racing away from me, and my chest lurches. I know this moment. I know it too well. The spark drops quickly down to the ground, landing in a fading fireball at my foot. I stomp it theatrically, raise my arms triumphantly. I meet Imran's eyes, and he's so immensely satisfied with me. He has no idea what the errant spark means. Loss of control. I tell myself it's a misstep. This is the first night with a new trick. It's not an unraveling. It's not the beginning of the end. But I don't know that I believe me. Later, I sit on the bench in the locker room, my head dropped into my hands. Hey, you all right? Jem's voice is soft, concerned. I look up at her, wanting to say I feel like soot. I feel blackened, and I'm terrified now, too. How is it possible to house so many different feelings in one body? How is there room for all this emptiness, all this fear, all this hate? I nod. Just tired, I think. You want to walk back together? Actually, I start, but I don't have to finish because Jem jumps in. You're going to see that guy tonight, aren't you? I manage a slight smile, and it's partly for Jem and partly for Taj. They seem to be the only things that can counteract the tangled mess of me. I think so, I say. I mean, yes. Yes, I am. Jem smiles broadly, and I mirror her. And soon she's telling me to go for it. And I tell her I want to. I really want to. You can do my Daisy tomorrow. I promise. Taj isn't waiting for me outside the lipstick building. He's not near any of the grates. I've circled the block 3 times. I've peeked into all the nearby grates that surround this building shaped like a tube of lipstick. I've whispered his name. I've called his name. I don't want to rub the lamp. Not yet. It seems so demeaning. I try one more time. Taj, are you there? Lost something? I look up, startled. An older woman with white hair and a bent-over back looks at me kindly. I thought I dropped my phone, I say, improvising. If my phone were named after a boy. Oh, dear. These grates are so dangerous. I thought perhaps you'd lost a doggy under the sidewalks. I once did. But then I found him near the park. A nice young man brought him back for me. Then there's a bleeding sound from my back pocket. My ringtone. I grab my phone. Elise is calling. Looks like you found it, the lady says with a smile, and shuffles off. Hey, I say into the phone. Aren't you out at sea? Yeah, but we're closer to shore now, so I finally got a decent signal. But it won't last long, and I have to tell you something. Is everything okay? I ask, as I step away from the grate and walk to the doorway. Yeah, obviously, but I kinda think I should be asking you that question. Are you using a grantor? Her voice sounds tense. Yes, but what do you have to tell me? Is everything okay? Listen, it's your brother. I close my eyes and grasp for the nearest thing, the rough edges of a brick building, to steady myself. What's going on? He's fine, but Kyle said one of his buddies saw Xavi over at the abandoned mental institution and that he was using his fire. You know the place I'm talking about? I know it too well. Yep. I sink down to the sidewalk, crouching. Is he doing more than lighting up at the abandoned asylum? I'm not sure. Kyle thought he saw him shooting off flames near an old car, too. He gave him kind of a warning. Kyle said Xavier was there with a bunch of guys he might have known from his time in prison. They were doing all sorts of stuff, you know? Yeah, I can imagine. I know you can't stop him. I know you're not even here and you have a million things on your mind, but maybe you can talk some sense into him. I mean, if he's caught by the authorities, then, well, you know, it's life for sure.
I know, I say, my voice heavy.
I just don't think he'll listen to me, though.
But you should try. And I'm still working on August. You may not have to...
Then the line goes dead. But I have to, I want to say. I have to.
From my perch on the sidewalk, I dial Xavier. He picks up on the first ring.
You need to stop, I tell him, not bothering with small talk.
They're on to you. The cops are going to find out. You need to stop, and you need to stop now before you do something stupid. You need to look out for Jana.
Stop? You're crazy. We've already sold like 80 tickets to our first show. We're gonna bring in some serious change.
Don't you get it, Xavi? You have a record. They know who you are. They're keeping an eye on you. They'll be thrilled to send you away forever if you light up another car.
Aria, I've told you not to worry about me.
I am worried about you, Xavi. I need you, and I love you, and I can't have you locked up again. And you have to look out for Jana. So stop this stuff, please. I'm making some money, and next year when I'm 18, I won't have to split the paychecks with Dad. And I can give you whatever money you need.
Aria, I'm not taking money from you.
Why not?
You're my baby sister.
And Jana is our baby sister, so you can't afford to get locked up. Be careful, Xavi. Are you keeping an eye on her like I told you?
Yes. I even went with them to the beach on Sunday, okay?
The beach, I say, tensing up because that's the worst place for my dad to take Jana.
Yeah, the beach. That big expanse of sand that meets the ocean. You familiar with it?
Yes, Xavi, but... I let my voice trail off, afraid to say the words out loud.
But what?
Did anything happen?
Happen like what?
I suck in a breath, then blurted out. Did Dad hurt Jana? He scoffs as if the idea is ludicrous.
No! He was swimming with her the whole time. Whole day. It was fabulous. I was even able to fall asleep in the sun.
My heart falls. Xavi, please be careful. I love you.
I'll try, he says. I love you too.
Then we say goodbye, and I stare at the phone for a few seconds, wishing I could unwind the day, tie it up, and tuck it away in a drawer while I rewrite my messed up, broken family into a normal, happy one. Instead, I try again for Taj. I return to the lipstick building, to the grate where I'm supposed to have a kinda, sorta, maybe date. I exhale when I see a strong hand holding up the grate a few inches. I kneel.
Hi. Hi. Can I come up?
Do you need my permission? I ask. He nods.
Yes.
But you didn't the first night.
That was the first night. And last night, you came down to the library, but I couldn't leave until you okayed it. Because now, I am at your beck and call. You know, that old bond thing between grantor and wisher.
Master and servant. The roles don't technically make sense because the grantor possesses incredible monstrous power, yet the wisher claims all the control. Taj shifts his eyes to the grate he's holding up. His arms must be quite strong, his muscles under those long shirt sleeves sharp and defined. I stare at his arms, at the way the fabric of those crisp shirts he wears stretches across his muscles when he holds up the grate. The heavy iron grate.
Of course, come up, I say, breaking my reverie.
He lifts the grate higher and swings his body up onto the sidewalk, then drops the grate with a heavy clang. He brushes one palm against the other.
Sorry I'm late. I was talking to my mom.
Your mom? Is she down there?
No. But we have other ways to communicate. We try to talk now and then, since grantors can't see their family members. but I like talking to her. I wish my mom would talk to me, I say wistfully. Then my eyes go wide at the word I just used aloud with a grantor. I hold up a hand. Wait, that wasn't a wish. That wasn't an official wish.
Don't worry, Aria. You'd have to offer me something first. Don't forget, there's always an exchange.
What should I offer you? I ask, because I know soon I'll have to pay. Soon I'll need to come up with some kind of currency.
Do you want to get into this? Into how the exchange works? Whenever you're ready, I'll tell you. That's how it works. You say you're ready, and I am instantly obligated as a master grantor to review all the rules, provisos, and conditions of wishing, and the guidelines you'll have to follow for payment.
There goes his free will again. There go his choices. The more I get to know him, the more I learn he's a lot like me. He doesn't have a lot of choices. But I still have free will, and so the least I can do is let him have a taste of what it's like to be free for a night. After my evening, I'd rather have a respite for a few hours. No, not now at least. Let's do something else, I suggest. Then insecurity rears its head. I don't even know if he likes me. I mean, if you want to.
Want to crash another show? Go bowling? Mini golf? Walk in the park? See the rooftop of the MetLife Tower?
My eyes widen.
Yes, that one. The last one.
Taj reaches for my hand, and we're not underground. He's not leading me through tunnels. He's just holding my hand. I slide my fingers into his and meet his eyes. There's a flicker between us, a spark in our touch, and I'm pretty sure it has nothing to do with being grantor and wisher, and everything to do with being boy and girl alone in the big city at night. Chapter 22. Ticking Clock. The MetLife Tower is streaked with gray, but it's not from dirt or soot. It's from a marbling of the stone that forms the building. At night, the building is eerie and shadowy, as if it's shrouded in secrets. As if the building could talk, tell us things it's seen in the city after hours. Or maybe Taj is the one who could tell me things. He must have seen all the corners of New York. He dips his free hand into a pocket and shows me a key. Grantor perk?
Nope. I did a job for a security guard's sister a while ago. And so naturally you have a key to the MetLife Tower. To many buildings, actually. New York Times Building, the New World Trade Center, even the Empire State Building.
Really?
Really indeed, O ye of little faith.
And you got them all from a security guard?
Taj shrugs casually. He had to make a trade. For his sick sister. He needed to pay up. That's what he had, so that's what he paid with. It works well for me.
Soon we'll have to talk about payment. Soon I'll have to find the currency I can trade with, too. He notices the change in my features.
Don't worry. You'll get to pay me, too, he says, making light of this reality, of the fact that he probably hates being a bank for people like me.
I don't have much.
Everyone thinks that. But everyone has something they can part with when they have a great enough need. Does this mean you're ready?
Yes, I want to say. Yes, because of Xavier now. But I need one more night for me.
No, not yet. Good. Because I hear it's beautiful on the balcony.
Taj puts a hand on my back, and his fingertips slide across the fabric of my shirt in a way that sends shivers through my skin. I wonder if he knows his touch is doing something to me, making me feel things I've never allowed myself to feel. He steers me around to the side of the building, to what looks like a fire exit. He presses the key into the lock and pulls the door open. We're in a stairwell that extends to the top of the building, as far as I can tell. I start to walk up the steps.
We can take the elevator.
He nods to the door that must lead to the lobby. Oh, I can manage the stairs, I say playfully.
You think I can't? That's cute. That's really cute.
Up we go, nearly 50 flights of stairs, legs burning, lungs aching, panting as we reach the top floor.
Didn't realize you'd be getting a workout tonight, too, did you?
See, I know how to bring it when it comes to F-U-N, he says. Next time, let's try the Empire State Building. You might be forgetting this girl works out every day.
Oh, show off,
he teases. And now he's just the boy who likes to have fun with a girl. There are so many facets to him, and I want him to know that I have many sides to me, too. Only I hardly ever show them. We're near the top of the building now, and he holds the door open for me. I walk out onto the balcony. It circles the peak of the MetLife Tower with a spire above us, a clock right below us. A high fence surrounds the perimeter, and there's a perfect view of Manhattan, the rivers that surround the island, and the towns that lie far beyond. I gaze up at the sky. The stars are barely visible. The city below is a quiet hum of a radio at night. It's amazing, I whisper as I wrap my fingers around the railing at the edge of the building.
It is. It really is,
he says, and his tone has the sound of the first time, as if he's drinking in this view for the first time. I turn to look at him, at his profile, his sharp cheekbones, his dark skin, his hair the color of night. He shifts his gaze to me. You've never been up here before, have you? He shakes his head. What about the other buildings you have the keys to?
Never been to them either.
Because your wisher would have to want to go? I ask, though it's more a statement, because this is a puzzle I'm putting together.
You got it.
Can I ask you something?
Of course.
Do you usually take your other wishers, or potential wishers, or whatever they're called? Whatever we're called, I say, stumbling through my question as my cheeks flame red. You know, around the city or whatever? He doesn't answer right away. Instead, he touches my wrist with his index finger, tracing a line across my skin. His touch is magnetic. I want to feel his fingertips draw roadmaps all over my arms. I try to concentrate on something else, on the view, on the city, on the phone calls I just had, on my faraway family. But I can't grab hold of them. They are slippery, and they slink away like banished ghosts, forbidden from my here and now.
No,
he says, then runs his finger up my bare arm, across the inside of my elbow.
I never wanted to, nor did I ever have the opportunity. Most wishers aren't interested in hanging out. They don't want to get to know their grantor. They make their wish, they pay, and then they go. Or they don't make their wish, and they leave.
So what does that make me? Indecisive? I ask, as his hands reach my hair. I lean into his hands, letting him slide his fingers through the thick strands of my hair. His moves are slow and gentle, as if he savors each touch. I don't have questions about him anymore. They are all vapor. They have all turned to mist. There are only answers, and he's giving them all to me in a way I feel is not a one-way street.
I don't know. Are you indecisive? Do you want to make a wish right now?
Kind of, I whisper.
What would you wish for?
His hand reaches the back of my head. His other hand finds my waist and rests on the edge of my miniskirt. We are so close now, separated by less than inches.
Hypothetically, of course, he adds.
Hypothetically, I repeat, my eyes locked on his deep brown eyes, as if I'm in a trance. I think I might not have to wish for it, I think it might happen anyway.
He raises an eyebrow in that playful way he has.
Presumptuous, are you?
I nod, lick my lips as he holds me tighter, brings me closer, my hips against his hand in my hair.
I want you to kiss me, I say.
Your want is my command.
His lips brush mine. His kiss is soft and tender, his lips gentle and lingering on mine. It is a slow kiss, a warm kiss, and it's enough to make me melt into his touch. I part my lips, and soon we're kissing more deeply. My hands are reaching into his hair, silky and soft. He doesn't have that soapy, woody smell of other boys. He smells like oranges, and he tastes like sunshine. The perfect contrast to the shadows in my body, the dark space between my muscles. The more I kiss him, the more I taste him, the more of him I want. Somehow we've managed to move even closer, and I feel warmer than I've been before, and freer. I don't bring any baggage, or history, or walls when I'm with him. I'm the opposite of who I've been, and with him, all I want is closeness. All I want is more of this. Soon, we pull apart for air.
To answer your question, no.
No what? What question? I ask.
Have I kissed my wishers before?
I wasn't going to ask that, I say, but my big fat grin gives away my white lie.
He runs a finger across my top lip, and I'm about to lean in for another kiss, but then his hands are on my cheeks, cupping my face.
You're the only one I've spent time like this with, Arya.
My face is flushed and my heart is lurching toward him. I don't know how any of this has happened, but yet I know exactly how it's happened, too. Because he's the first boy I've ever led into my heart, and I don't want to make a wish, because in so doing, I'd be wishing him away.
I thought about you before I came to New York, I whisper.
His eyebrows knit together in question.
I saw your picture when I was in Florida. Mariska posted it online. I thought you were beautiful.
Beautiful, he repeats with a smile.
You are. I want to draw you.
Draw me?
I make little graffiti drawings. I want to try drawing you.
I want to watch you do that.
I want to keep seeing you, I whisper. He leans his forehead against mine.
Me too.
Then he pulls back.
But I have a job to do, and you have a need, and we should talk payment soon.
He's serious again, but this time he's business serious, by the book serious.
Taj, I don't want to talk about that. But we have to.
Why? You said we only had to talk about it when I brought it up, that was part of being a mastered grantor, I say, and the last two words taste bitter. Still, I don't want to go there right now. A shadow falls across his eyes. The warmth of a few seconds ago starts to dissipate.
Because that's part of being bound. You might be able to do whatever you want, but I can't just run around forever and ever. Sure, you're my master, and you can dictate what I do, but we can't play at this until the end of time.
Why not? Maybe I should run away. Maybe we could run away.
We could get out of here. Get out of town. We could go. You'd never have to live underground again. You'd never have to stop living again. You could just be, right?
It occurs to me that it would be far too early in a normal relationship to suggest running away with a boy. But this isn't a normal relationship by any stretch, so I don't feel clingy or needy by asking him. I feel as if I'm taking charge of my own fate.
Ar, I love the thought, but I can't.
He holds his palms out, showing me they're empty, of course. there's always a ticking clock.
Why? Do you turn into a pumpkin at midnight for real? Do you expire after 7 days with a wisher?
He shakes his head.
If we ran away, then you'd, for all intents and purposes, no longer be in such desperate need of a wish. That's how I found you, remember? That's how you found me. I don't come to everyone who needs something. Some people need things in life. A home, good health, escape. But they're not wanting to wish, so we don't appear. But when someone is so hungry for a wish, like you were, that's when I'm called. I could sense your need, your deep, desperate need to wish. That's what summoned me to you. When you stop needing a wish, you'll no longer be my wisher. When someone decides they no longer need a wish, I can't be kept at their beck and call, he explains.
Is that what happened to Mariska the night I met you? She was done wishing, so you were no longer at her beck and call?
Her situation was a bit different, he says evasively.
So what happens if I don't need a wish, then?
I won't be able to come out to see you. I'll cease to exist, whether you wish or not. It's only the condition of your needing something so badly that keeps me with you. When that goes away, I can't stay.
It's as if I've been dreaming, sinking farther away into pretend, into the land of make-believe. Now I've been harshly awakened. This thing between us is like my fire, always ticking, always unwinding. I kick the rooftop, a petulant child. I wish there were another way. I walk away for a minute. That wasn't a real wish, I call out, and I pace toward the other edge of the balcony, thinking, working through scenarios, looking for a loophole. But I find none, because magic makes its own loopholes. It circles back in on itself and twists inward, like those trees whose roots sprout back up to form new branches, but they're all part of the same mother tree, never splintering off to become their own. I walk back to him. The faint sound of a siren plays far below, cars and life happening many stories away. How exactly does the payment thing work? I need information so I can come up with a plan.
Wishes don't come for free.
That much is loud and clear. How do I pay?
Dearly. You pay dearly, he says through clenched teeth, as if the words pain him.
Like how dearly? The key the guy gave you? That hardly seems very high a price.
It was for him.
The keys were his livelihood. He didn't just give me keys. He gave up his job in exchange for the wish. Besides, his sister became well again, so I assume he felt it was worth it. Oh, so the keys are sort of symbolic. But that doesn't seem fair for him to give up a job.
I don't make the rules, Arya. I have no say in them. I only administer them. It's not as if I wanted this job. It's not as if I asked for it. I may have the magic, but I have no say, he says, enunciating the last two words carefully.
So how else do people pay for wishes? With money?
He shakes his head. Rarely with money. Some people have paid for wishes with their children.
I stop pacing and stare hard at him. Their children? You can't be serious.
Big wishes come at a big price.
That's awful.
Some people pay with their hearts. Some offer their souls. Some offer themselves.
Themselves? Like they give you their bodies? I ask, and I can't keep the jealousy out of my question. He senses it and laughs.
No, not that way, Arya. But I'm glad to know it bothers you.
Stop, I say. Don't go all sexy on me again. I want information.
Sexy? You think I'm sexy?
Yes. Anyway, how do they pay with their bodies?
Not their bodies, he says, laughing. Some pay with themselves. They offer themselves in a trade. Then, when it's time to collect on the debt, they would trade places with a grantor.
But you're still here, so no one has offered you themselves.
Correct. But I've seen what other wishers have offered.
In the registry? Is it like a big book?
He nods. Yes. Grantors are all in a union. We're regulated. And every wish is recorded in our registry within 24 hours of it being granted. That way, wishers can't ever wish again. You get one wish for life, and that's it. It keeps wishers from abusing grantors. It prevents grantor addiction. That was a big problem many years ago. Wishers kept coming back, or they'd find other grantors they hadn't used before, so the union implemented more checks and balances.
That makes sense.